Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening and happy Shabbat to one and all. I'm here with Kirk. And Kirk, before we begin, and we're going to dig into what I think is the single most important subject in the entirety of God's message to us, which is how to become part of the covenant. Chapter 10 and 11 of Observations for Our Time are based exclusively on the terms and conditions of the covenant, all the conversations Yahweh had with Abraham, and then the test that Abraham had to pass for God to say, you qualify. And we'll dig back into that in a moment. I just read an article today that I found absolutely astonishing. The article was on the United States Department of Defense. It has decided that it needs to change its focus, that previously it had been focusing on Islamic jihadists as the principal foe America faces. I mean, after all, we made Afghanistan worse in a never-ending war. We're still there. We completely destroyed Iraq, gave it to Iran, and turned the world upside down, essentially lit the fuse for World War III by doing that. And then we invaded Syria, no timetable to get out. Have completely destroyed that country, have sent millions upon millions of Muslim refugees throughout the world, spreading their cancer. And, oh, in the meantime, we also used our military to bomb and destroy Libya. Mm-hmm. So, no, we don't want to see what we can do with our military to make it maybe once in a lifetime effective somewhere in the Islamic world. We're just going to continue to blow up the Islamic world and make it worse. No, according to the 11-page report on the new focus of the U.S. military, it is no longer Islamic jihadists and Islamic terrorists. No, our new enemies, Russia and China. When was the last time that that America faced a military threat from Russia?
Never.
I guess when we were manufacturing bombs and airplanes and tanks and everything else for Russia, and they used our weapons against us. They used our weapons against us in Vietnam. So when they fought a proxy war against us in Vietnam, and then we fought a proxy war against them in Afghanistan that worked out miserably for both countries, enough that if you were a rational, moral person, if you were a citizen of either country, you would hate your country for what it did.
Right.
And in China, but when was the last time we fought a war against China?
We never did there either.
Oh, no, that's not also
possible.
It's just like Russia. We did, well, the last war that Russia was wholly involved in, Russia was an ally of the United States. That would be World War One. We fought Russia
by
proxy. We fought Russia by proxy in Vietnam and by proxy in Afghanistan. No, we fought China by proxy too. Korea. After the United States turned on Chiang Kai-shek and scuttled him and then started funneling our weapons to Mao Zedong, Mao Zedong thanked the United States by, first of all, killing about 40 million of his own people, 50 million of his own people, and then he invaded North Korea so that Americans would lose another 35,000 troops in North Korea thanks to China. That was the last time we fought China.
Yeah, but we never had a threat from those people. We chose to go do battle with them because we didn't like what they were doing or what we perceived them to do.
We actually had no threat ever from Vietnam. Could care less about the Russians and us until we invaded, and once we invaded, the Russians decided to arm them, but they were giving them arms that American companies were making for them. And in North Korea, had we not invaded North Korea, we would never have confronted Chinese troops. And last time I checked, North Korea was on the border of China. It is not on the border of the United States.
Right.
But since that time, we've had absolutely no military interaction with either country. So the person who is releasing the so-called national defense strategy, that's why I just despise the U.S. military. I mean, I despise it with every fiber of my body. He said, this is his quote, "We face growing threats from revisionist powers as different as China and Russia, nations that seek to create a world consistent with their authoritarian models," Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said in a speech presenting the document. What a piece of crap.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse my French. What in the hell is a revisionist power? First of all, what is a revisionist power? Why didn't somebody stand up and say, what in the hell is a revisionist power? What does that mean to revise? What are they revising?
Well, if they're thinking they're trying to convince you it's the old Soviet Union, that's not so easy. I mean, these people are very
nationalistic,
and who cares?
I have no clue what a revisionist power is, and I am absolutely certain that the United States has not faced a threat from China or Russia in the last 50 years. I am.
For 50 years, at least, during so much of my lifetime, they've had to give them wheat in Russia so they wouldn't starve. That's not your enemy when you're doing that. And in
our
China,
biggest trading partner in the world is China.
It's China. Right. And, of course, Russia has half of the control of the other minerals that China doesn't. So
I would agree that politically China is authoritarian. When did we not learn that cannot impose democracy? That if a country wants to be authoritarian, they're going to be authoritarian. Did you see China trying to export communism into Japan, into South Korea, into the Philippines? Do you see any place where China is trying to impose communism on a surrounding country? Are they going to Afghanistan and say, America really messed you up. What you need is
you need communism. Yeah, right.
So are they spreading communism? That was our old domino theory. No, they're not. They're our largest economic trading partner. China has no ability whatsoever under any circumstance to project a force, invade anything bigger or further away than Taiwan. They have no means whatsoever to project a force. And since countries are businesses, if your largest trading partner far and away was the United States, if you were China, and by the way, you own enormous amounts of the United States because you've got to do something with all the money they throw at you for goods and services, would you invade a country that, A, you own, and B, is the dominant
you're destroying yourself.
Proponent of your economy?
Yeah, you're going to blow up yourself. I mean, your customers and plus stuff you already own. You just don't do it.
It's ludicrous. Okay.
Yeah.
And then with Russia. He he calls Russia authoritarian. Excuse me. Last time I checked, they have elections there. People choose their own leader. You may not like Putin. I happen to like him. But you may not like Putin.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not no more authoritarian than is the President of the United States.
Less, I would think.
Is Mattis still living back in the old evil empire days? Is he that stupid?
Apparently. Or he thinks you are. You being collective us.
And then he blames, he says, that China was not as brazen as Russia was in their use of their military power, and he blames them for the invasion and the annexation of the Ukraine. Well, when it comes to Crimea, the people voted 98% to 2% to be part of Russia.
Yeah.
And the only reason they were put in a position to vote is because the United States State Department inspired the riots that overthrew the popularly elected government.
Yeah.
And then you had the people in the eastern part of the Ukraine that speak Russian, that are ethnically Russians, that their heritage has always been with Russia, and now the United States goes and screws it up and creates a government by coup as opposed to election. And we're mad at Russia for intervening in the Ukraine. When it's the United States that is arming the Ukraine, the United States that is funding the Ukraine, the United States that inspired the coup? Do these people think that everybody they're talking to, including the press, are absolute nincompoops?
They must be.
God, you read this kind of stuff. And you have a country that has failed miserably every time it is tempted to invade, occupy, or modify an Islamic country. Afghanistan twice, Iraq, Syria, the Sudan, Somalia, Libya, Egypt. Everything we've touched in the Islamic world with our military, we have made a disastrous mess, made the situation infinitely worse, pushed the world to the precipice of World War III. And now,
we want to pick on the other guy.
Russia and China, we're picking a fight and saying they're public enemy number one. They're a real threat. They're the revisionist power. And therefore, we need to go after them. You know, where is Russia saying to countries, you know, you better have our brand of government or else we're going to send in our military?
Nowhere.
They blame them for intervention in Syria. That was one of the State Department claims that's what we got to be prepared for Russia. They blame them for intervention in Syria. Last time I checked, Syria's largest trading partner was Russia.
Mm-hmm.
What did they expect? We were making a mess of it. We were going to overthrow Saddam Hussein, Assad.
Yeah.
We were going to overthrow Assad like we did Saddam Hussein, like we did Gaddafi, making the situation infinitely worse with those who replaced them. We were going to create exactly the same mess in Syria. And the Russians kept us shooting ourselves in the third foot. I mean, if we have 3 feet, that was going to be the third shot in the foot, and they kept us from doing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was the only thing that kept us. Remember, we were doing Syria at the time on your day show, and shattering this. And we were saying, my God, how can this prophecy come true about Damascus? Because over there, they're going to blow this place up. And then Russia came in, and obviously Yahweh had already seen that, to know that.
Yeah.
Or he had seen ahead of it and know that it didn't happen. So we were trying to figure out.
We could not have made it to 2026, 2027 for Damascus being a heap of rubble if Russia had not intervened.
Right.
Because the way the United States was going, we were going to turn that entire region into a living hellhole where no one could live. It sent everybody in that region to countries around the world.
It was interesting. Most of the I was reading some stuff on the people that were moving away from there. Most of them moved towards the government in that thing. You know, there's something like 4 or 5 million Syrians who, instead of fleeing to other countries, they flew to the side where the Assad was. So
yeah.
What does that tell you? Which side you picked?
It tells you exactly the same thing we should have learned elsewhere. The Roman Catholic Church is God's number one enemy on the planet. But when the Pope went to Syria, he knew where he had to ally, because Assad was far more willing to protect Christians from being molested by Muslims,
right?
Than any other of the foes that are fighting there. And look at Syria, that whole mess that we equip and arm and deploy the Kurds. We use the Kurds to wipe out the Islamic State in Syria. And today, Turkey started a long campaign of bombing the very Kurds that removed the Islamic State.
Yeah. We are so stupid.
Oh, God. So you read this kind of stuff, and you realize how stupid we are. Now, the reason I wanted to start with this is because one of the things that we talked about as we began our presentation, and it'll be posted on the various sites, I think, quite soon, about this, the program we did today on the first two statements about the introduction to the covenant discussions with Abraham, is that the first man's name that is mentioned is Terach. In fact, I'll read Bereshit in the beginning, Genesis 11:26. And Terach, the living embodiment of the two messages of Teruah, proclaiming the joyous news of God's beneficial healing while rebuking man's fraudulent treachery and deceit, lived 70 years, and he fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now, our whole discussion began with the realization that in those four names, everything you need to know is laid out before you. If you are thoughtful, everything you need to know. And Terach's name is important because he is the name that says there are two forks in the road here. You can go right, you can go left. You go left, you're going to stay with man. You're going to die with man. You go right, and it'll take you to Yahweh. There's a path to Yahweh, and then there's man's ways which lead away from him. Reliance on one's military for protection is walking away from God. There is no one on the entire planet in the history of mankind who has relied on their military for their freedom, for their protection, that is in heaven or that will ever end up in heaven. And Yahweh's statements in Yeshaya 13 and 14 about the military, he is literally turning everyone involved in the military worldwide into goo, liquefying them.
Yeah.
He wants nothing to do with them. He thinks they're revolting. And so if you are among those who are engaged in militarism, think that your military is part of the solution, that they're going to protect you, you're true. It's over.
Mm-hmm.
No chance whatsoever.
Yeah. Go back to Samuel. He said, don't have one army. This is what.
Yes.
How many times did Yahweh have to say, don't do this?
Think after a while, people would gradually begin to figure it out. But that's the story that we need to hear. More and more, we need to hear the story of the fact that there are two ways. There's man's way and there's God's way. And that, hang on one second, let me take care of my puppy dog. I'll be right back with you. My apologies, but she's old, lame, blind, and if she gets up and starts walking towards the door and I don't deal with it, then my next chore is to deal with clean that pee from the carpet. Not my favorite thing to do, and it was time. So that was life gets in the way, and you know I don't apologize too for it's just such a perfect presentation of unconditional love. They are, for those who have not had a dog, and I know you've had dogs, But if you've not had a dog yet, that's really an experience that I would encourage everyone to have, just to enjoy their companionship. But that's the meaning of Turok, and that's why I wanted to talk about the stupidity of squandering $1 trillion a year in the U.S. military based upon idiots like Mattis saying that, yep, the revisionist nations, Russia and China, those authoritarian models, and try and seek to create a world consistent with their authoritarian model. Here the United States is engaged in more nation building than the rest of the world combined. Probably since the Carthaginians, no one has been as much focused on trying to make the world in their model than the United States. Mm-hmm. Russia and China aren't doing that at all. And yet we blame them for doing what we have been the worst at in the history of humanity. So Turok represents that. Turok is saying, you got two paths. You can join the stupidity of humankind, and you can slurp that stuff up like it's Kool-Aid. Because there wasn't a single reporter or politician there that said, hey, wait a minute, stupid. That's the most absurd thing I've ever heard. What are you, crazy? But no one was there. And, of course, the next three names are the three doors. Now, Abraham, the father who lifts up, he represents door number one into the covenant. Nahor means the one who snores. He represents door number two, which is into oblivion. You go through life comatose, you never wake up.
You're a couch potato, that's okay. There's no reward at the end. There's no relationship at the end.
No heaven, no hell. You know, we get letters from people time to time that says, you know, I think what you're saying about God is true and that the covenant is true, but I can't accept it because, you know, my son or daughter died, and I have to believe they're in heaven, that I will see them one day. So I'm going to take a pass. And, you know, I'm sorry. Your son and daughter are not in heaven. They're not in hell either. They're not in heaven. Because of your poor decisions, they don't know Yahweh or theirs. They don't know Yahweh. Yahweh does not know them. They just simply don't exist. All that exists of them is in your memory. And if you continue to be religious, believing that they're in heaven, then the only memory of them, which is in your minds,
will fade away.
Yeah, will die. Yeah, right along with you.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's the nature of things. So Abraham represents that. Nahor represents the door number two. And Haran, he is door number three. He was the high and mighty one who, by high and mighty, he's dealing with politicians and religious leaders. He is the promoter of such things. And so he represents door number three, the express ticket to Sheol. The next statement is, and so from this perspective, the word for perspective was Elah. Elah means both oath and curse, promise of the covenant and condemnation. Again, it's showing that there are two ways to go, and you can choose one or the other. You can't have both. Mm-hmm. And that needs to be absolutely drilled into people's heads. If you want to be religious, that's your choice. You will never know God. If you want to be political, that's your choice. You will never know God. You want to be patriotic, that's your choice. You will never know God. You want to be pro-military, that's your choice. You will be excluded from heaven. Period. There are no exceptions.
Christianity and Easter with you either. That's the most disgusting thing to God you can absolutely have around you.
So if you're any one of those four things, you are religious, political, patriotic, or militaristic in nature. You will never, those are choices that preclude you from knowing him. Now, it does not mean that if you were to forego those four things, which very few people will do, but if you were to forego all four of those things, that does not get you entrance into heaven, but at least get you in a position where you have that opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
The opportunity is not even available.
They never tell
to you
that you do.
Correct. So it is from this perspective that the account of Turok, that's the living embodiment of the two ways, Turok fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Those are the three doors. And then Haran fathered Lot. Lot means one who is shrouded, blocking any association with the light. Now, Kirk, we talked about this in the previous show, but the thing most people don't understand about Lot is that Christians think that, well, you know, God himself saved Lot. Lot had to be a really good guy. No, Lot was a piece of crap. Lot was a piece of crap.
I doubt if he was practicing Pesach in Sodom either.
No, of course not. He chose to go to Sodom.
It could only be because of
He was offering his daughter's virginity to be raped from her. You know, no. He ended up having incest with his daughters. He got drunk and lost control. No. You know, that Lot is not a good guy. Lot was spared, not because of Lot, but because of Abram. Yahweh loved Abram, and Abram was negotiating with him, saying, because there's, you know, I don't know why he didn't just come out and say it. It was, you know, 1,000 good people, 100 good people, 50 good people. Why didn't you just come out and say, hey, you know, my nephew Lot's down there.
Uh-huh.
Could you spare him before you destroy the place? And God is interested. That's what I'll do. So then Haran, in the presence of Terach, his father, in the country of his relatives, and with whom he identified politically and religiously, Moledeth, of his birth, with a focus on the customs and culture of his people. That's what it means. In Ur, of the Casdim Babylonians. So then Haran perished. I think I forgot to read the word perished. I'm sorry. So Haran perished is the verb. Muth died a mortal death in the presence of Terach, his father, in the country of his relatives with whom he identified politically and religiously, in Ur of the Casdim, the Babylonians. What happens if you don't get out of Babylon? At the end of your life, whenever it is, short, long, if you never leave Babylon, what happens?
Well, you're still down to two choices. You're supporting it,
yep,
or preaching it. And
yep.
There's death either way. It's just whether your soul will continue to be in a disgusting place.
Yep. Yeah, you've eliminated door one. You're going to either die and cease to exist, or you're going to die and your soul is going to Sheol.
And it has to be that way for Yahweh to be fair. So
right.
It's not a...
Correct.
What else can you do?
So the story of Haran ends right there because he never left Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
Because he never walked away from the religion or politics of his people. There's no covenant for him. No heaven for him. No relationship with God for him. The best thing that could ever have happened to Haran is that death was the end of his life. That's it.
But I expect he would be in Sheol just because of the, unless it's a total metaphor, so I mean, it's still three places, and he qualifies for the third place. So
he sure does. Yeah, I'd be surprised if Haran is not in Sheol. I would agree with you completely. So he grasped hold of and took Abram. This is Lakah. Third person masculine singular, and thus addressing Terach. So this is not Yahweh took hold of. This is Terach. So he grasped hold of and took, selected and take, led away Abram and Nahor. So Abram, father who lifts up, and Nahor, one who snores, with their wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, meaning noble woman, wife with status, leader and branch, official offshoot. It's from Sarah, which is how she was originally named, or would ultimately become named, to contend and strive with, to engage and endure with, to struggle and wrestle with, to be empowered by and persist with, to exert oneself with and persevere, to be set free by an upright leader with royal birth who is empowered, a liberator. The name of Snor's father, for Snor's wife, Nahor's wife, was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the high and mighty, whose fortress is overthrown and pulled down, who is now dead, the father of Milcah and the father of Yikah, observant. So all of these names tell us this story. So then, Sarai, it's S-A-R-A-Y, noble woman, this would be Abram's wife, was infertile, for she was without child. Why do you think she was infertile?
Because, you've speculated, I totally agree, is because until she got away from that, she could produce nothing worthwhile until they got out of there. Once they walked away, then she,
Yahweh wanted her first child with her husband, Abram, to be the part of the covenant family.
Yeah.
And that's why, Abram having a son through Hagar was useless. He wanted the symbolism of you're never too old to become part of the covenant.
Right.
Moshe was 80.
Mm-hmm.
I was in my late 40s, almost 50. Mm-hmm. It's not uncommon to become part of the covenant late in life. He wanted to emphasize that. He wanted to emphasize that the covenant is like a human family, mother, father, child. And the first child born to Abram and Sarah would be the first child of the covenant. So I think she was infertile because Yahweh wanted a tangible way to express how similar the covenant is to our everyday family lives. Now I've got to go and let my pooch in because it's still 6 inches of snow outside.
Well, I don't want to freeze to death.
So I'll be right back. Okay. So, Kirk, that was my Dan Rather moment where I walked away and set my dog back inside. But, for the moment of silence there for those that might complain. What are we paid for this program?
Oh, a great sum of nothing.
Yeah, that's correct.
There's a lot of things for it.
We do it as a labor of love. I do care for my old ailing blind and deaf dog, and so I let her back in. So she wouldn't freeze out there.
Mm-hmm.
All right, this is now Bereshit 11:31. Terach, recording again, the embodiment of Truah, the two ways, grasped hold of and took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, the wife of his son, Abram, father who uplifts. Do you think there's a reason maybe that God is giving you? We already know who all the players are, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing new here, but he is reinforcing the fact that this is an extended family.
Right.
He's establishing the relationship between Abraham and Terach, his father.
Right.
Because one of the terms and conditions of the covenant, you don't just walk away from your country, which they were doing. You got to walk away from your father's house. So it's got to be well understood that Terach, the fork in the road, as Yogi Berra would say, if you come to a fork in the road, take it.
Right.
that Terach, father, Abraham, son, Lot, nephew of Abraham, explains what happened in Sodom. And he was the son of Haran, who was now dead, the high and mighty, never left Babylon, probably in Sheol. His grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, the wife of his son, Abram. And they came out with them from Ur of the Kastim, the Babylonians. Kastim means sages and astrologers, fortune tellers and magicians. The headstrong and the self-willed, the crippled, the lame, or those who crippled and lame, cause the stubborn to stagger and stumble. Ur is really the beady heart of the beast. You know, I know that Assyria, that first Babylon's capital was in Nineveh. Mm-hmm. And then Nineveh later became the capital of Assyria. And that there was actually a city, a first, second, and third city of Babylon itself. And that Babel is now the ultimate beast. It's the forefather of all beasts. But there was a city-state, a civilization that preceded them all. That
sure.
was the first to incorporate religion and politics and militaries and all of these kinds of things, come up with a writing system to convey them. And that was Ur, the city-state of Sumer.
Yeah. I looked both of those up between yes. the shows after I walked my dog and we ate and everything.
Uh-huh.
And everything there is pretty easy to find. It's the seat of the moon god worship. It became the sun god worship place. It became, you know, a light flame, rising sun. I mean,
the god that became the god of Islam, the crescent moon, the, mm-hmm. the moon god.
Right. Yeah.
The moon god's name is Sen, and Sen was first conceived as a mythical god in Ur,
mm-hmm.
and then the moon god religion of Sen, that's the crescent that Islam operates under, proliferated really all the way through the Mesopotamia. Mm-hmm. And particularly where they were going in Haran, really, really prolific there. In fact, that ultimately migrated to become the principal seat of worship of the moon god Sen. So, when Yahweh speaks of there's the greater and the lesser light, and you're wondering, you know, why is he using the lesser light, the moon, to describe the Satan? Well, because the first guise that Satan used was as the moon god.
That's right.
Sen.
Moon god, yes. You know, I use that in teaching. Interesting, perhaps, a little side. When I teach heart, and I'm talking about light hitting an object, and I'm talking about cold and warm colors, and I try to remind them that light reflects, and that the moon, of course, if you put moonlight on something, which is a reflected light, a much diminished light form, everything becomes cool. And then if you put a warm in the sunlight, of course, everything is warm, and then I approach it from the very same way, trying to show them what warm light hit something in its cold shadows and so forth and so on, without breaking into an art lesson. It's like people never really think about it very much.
It's also interesting, Kurt, that if you look at the...
It has no light. I can't tell them. The moon has no light. It's barring everything from the sun, and that's what Satan... So it's so good as a symbol for Satan, because he has nothing.
Yeah. It's not just that the moon is 400 times smaller than the sun.
Right.
The moon has no light at all.
No.
There really is no light.
Bouncing light.
No, all the moon does is it reflects the sun's light.
Right.
And so in the comparison between Yahweh and Satan, the Yahweh is the source of light. Satan simply reflects some of Yahweh's light.
Right.
And so the lesser light
is
just hugely different. And to appreciate Ur is to understand that Ur is where the first, I shouldn't say the first, because there is the possibility, not a possibility, a certainty. Yahweh speaks of first Babel, the Babel that was in the city of Nineveh when Nimrod established first Babylon in the city of Nineveh. That is the place where religion first took root. But the first place that was quantified, calibrated, promoted, turned into scripture that is recorded in the annals of human history, because we have nothing from that age of Nineveh and Babylon from Nimrod. Mm-hmm. Just too far back, and it's buried too far under ancient archaeological ruins that we have no access to because of the malfeasance of Muslims. So the only place we can turn to verify what the culture was like is Ur, and Ur represents essentially everything that God hates.
Mm-hmm.
So it shouldn't be a surprise that they come out of Ur. And you might say, wait a minute, why are you translating cast them as Babylonians? You know, it typically is given this gloss that of Chaldeans.
They're entertaining.
But there really, as I've said so many times, there really is no difference between Sumer, Chaldea, Babylon, and Assyria. Even when Yahweh uses the Medes to describe a group of people, they and the Babylonians are indistinguishable. There is no distinguishing characteristic that said, these tribes are Assyrian, these tribes are Babylonian, these tribes are Chaldean, these tribes are from Sumer. It's all the same.
Mm-hmm.
Same people, same place, same ideologies.
So, and we talk about being astrologers and professional magicians and astrologers and on and on and on.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the real problems of the Christian Christmas story is the three wise men. Well,
yeah,
they couldn't be wise men because they were astrologers. You know, when people are seeking credibility and they seek credibility by having people who believe things that are untrue say, hey, wow, that must be true. It's like the Quran. They were so desperate to validate Muhammad. They had, you know, every religious nincompoop alive that said, oh, yeah, I see the sign of a prophet's on him. He's got an apple-shaped mole on his back. It's desperate. And this idea that three wise men came from the East and gave him gifts. No. If they were wise, they wouldn't be astrologers. They wouldn't be sages in Babylon. They came from Babylon. They were religious nincompoops. A religious nincompoop saying, hey, wow, you are the cat's meow, does not add to one's credibility. They're lying about everything. So that is not a credibility boost for the Christian.
Don't hang your head on that one.
No. So they came out with them from Ur of the Babylonians, the Kashtim, and walked to the land of Canaan, which means lowly and subdued, Kana, to be brought down because of a pretentious attitude. Now, at the time I wrote this chapter, I was unaware that we knew much about the Canaanite religion. And
it
was much later, I think, like chapters...
Yeah.
16, 17, 18, something like that. That's kind of the interesting about to the connections that you make if you Google something. There was a reference to an Eastern star that was used in one of the depictions of the adversary of Hasatan in reference to Assyria, I believe. And I said, you know, I'll track that down. That's interesting. Because I would look at that as that's a direct reference to Hillel ben Shakar.
Mm-hmm.
And so I looked it up, and the first thing that as I was going down all the various things that I could learn about it, and that one of them cited the scriptures of the Babylonian religion. And so I followed it. Son of God, we have found now tablets
Catholic Church
written in Hebrew that describe the Canaanite religion.
Yeah.
And son of a gun, it's Christianity.
Yeah.
You know, it's the Lord God of Christianity. In fact, they even use the both terms, Lord and God. The chief deity was Baal-El, Lord God. And the whole religion is based on Christianity. So that was a really interesting awakening. So then this says, but they only came as far as Tehran. That's transliterated Haran, but it's the hard CH sound that begins it.
Mm-hmm.
And Haran is diseased by the sun to taunt and jeopardize through blaspheme. Well, I don't know if that was the case at the time, because I haven't studied the whole history of Iran. But I do know that at the time of the Babylonian fall, or 600-ish BCE, not the Babylonian, the Assyrian fall, when the Babylonians and the Medes collectively attacked Nineveh, and a couple of years later they were attacked and Haran fell as well, that at the time Haran was the center of the world for the worship of the moon god Sin. In fact, the old mosque, the great mosque of Haran, was a temple to Sin. But I think this predates that by, probably 1,800 years.
Yeah.
So the name, as the name implies, it may have been sun god worship at the time they were there. Anyway, they settled there. So they were at least had left Babylon. So the days of Terach, this would be Abraham's father, were 205 years. And Terach died in Haran. So while Haran died in Babylon, Terach died in Haran. What does that tell you about the fate of Abram's father?
He's gone. Yeah, he has no hope.
Yeah. My guess is that you are correct that Haran is in Sheol. I think that Terach is simply
dead. His father didn't walk him away. They walked away, but he never walked to anything. So he's probably just dead.
That is correct. Yep. So that is so profound, though, is that that Terach walked away from Babylon, led his family away from Babylon, but never walked to Yahweh. And so he simply ceases to exist while youngest son who died in Babylon, Haran is still there. He never left Babylon. He's going to go the way of Babel. Yeah, he's in Sheol. So just leaving Babylon is not enough to make one part of the covenant. All right, so he's got two members of the family died that did not get to know God. Now, this is but the preamble to the first seven meetings between Abram and Yahweh. And while we are eager to read what Yahweh is about to say, let's consider something that until I had begun to put these thoughts down on paper, I had failed to notice. And it's no small thing. It was a little over a decade ago that I made my initial connection, noting that since Abram was born and had lived in Ur of the Chaldeans, a pseudonym for Babylon, God's subsequent instruction to walk away from his country should be interpreted as disassociating from what Babel represents.
Right.
The confusion and resulting corruption associated with man's political, militant, patriotic, and religious rhetoric. And while this conclusion is absolutely valid, this was too important a point to leave up to interpretation. So God was considerably more matter-of-fact than I had previously noticed. The first condition of the covenant, walk away from your country.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Tangibly, where was Abram?
He was already beyond that.
Right. Way beyond the borders and the influence of Babylon. Extremely important. You cannot come to know God. God's not going to introduce himself to you. He's not going to invite you to become part of the covenant. And you have no chance of getting to know him until you first walk away from your country. No. That doesn't mean you have to do what Abram did in the sense of physically putting Babel in his rearview mirror.
You're right.
But it means to disassociate from, to reject the religious, patriotic, military, and political.
Well, that's all we can do because everywhere we go, we're surrounded by it. I mean, from East Coast, West Coast, Canada to Mexico, to South America, where are you going to go? I mean, you can be a hermit, I suppose, but that's about it. You cannot walk physically away from Babylon anymore. It's pervasive across the face of the earth.
But, you know, it was the case of Moshe.
Mm-hmm.
Moshe walked away from Egypt because he was disgusted by what he witnessed there.
Yeah.
There was a reason that Abram walked away from Ur, from Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, that was the power center of the world, the economic center of the world. They walked away because there's only one justification. They were disgusted by it. There was, the things that were going on in Canaan were horrible.
Yeah.
They were disgusting. So he was walking away because, from their point of view, nothing could have been as bad as what they were leaving. We were told twice, once in Bereshit 11:28 and again in 11:31, that Abram, his father, and certain members of his family had come out of Casdin, Babylon, the realm of religious sages, astrologers who crippled the lame and caused the stubborn to stumble. But I had not previously considered what transpired between these two pronouncements. Initially, we are told that Terach had lived childless for 70 years, what we would consider a full lifetime, with Babel as his only home and family. His firstborn was Abram, a child who would grow to become symbolic of the first family. He was named in honor of his mission, a father who lifts up and grows. But he was not an only child. There would be two more, Nahor, the one who snores, and Haran, representing the high and mighty who are overthrown, speaking of religious and political and militant individuals. Collectively, they represent the broad cross-section of humankind and are symbolic of the three doors through which souls pass at the conclusion of their mortal existence. The covenant opens the door to God's home. Religion, politics, militarism, well, that opens the door to Sheol. And then you have...
Yeah, the sleepwalkers.
Yep. Abram would listen to Yahweh and accept the conditions of the covenant. As a result, he would be lifted up and grow. He would pass through, pass over, the lone door and the first step to life with God. Nahor, the secondborn, represents the masses and thus doorway number two. Apathetic and unaware, lazy and irrational, he was victimized by confusing religious and corrupting political rhetoric. Snoring when he should have been observant, he eluded his father's grasp and stayed in Babel. He had the life he sought to protect, after all, especially with a wife called queen. She may have been childish, but she was Babylonian royalty. As for Nahor, he's never mentioned again. He would simply cease to exist. Think about that. He is never mentioned again. It's the fate of all of those infected with the Babylonian plague of death, the perverted rhetoric of religion and politics. The high and mighty Haran, the third born, is symbolic of the religious, political, military, and economic elite and their fate. It's doorway number three. He would surrender his mortal life in the presence of his father, Terach, and the land of his relatives surrounded and invested in Moladeth, his culture, customs, community, identifying himself with Ur, the enlightenment of the Kashdim, of the Babylonians who were overtly religious. By stating his fate this way, in this context, two things should become evident. First, by juxtaposing these things, Yahweh has defined Moladeth as Kashdim, a religious family. Those who relate to sages and astrologers, fortune tellers and magicians, in addition to the enlightened, who are directed by the morning star and rising sun, those who cripple the lame and cause the stubborn to stumble. Collectively, religious conservatives and political liberals created the cultures, customs, and communities in which the plague of death had festered and grown. Haran, the high and mighty, would be overthrown and brought down by God in judgment. As a result, he would spend an eternity with his fellow babblers. And that's as we progress through Yashaya, we get up to the 12th, 13th, 14th chapters. God is saying, the high and mighty, he is going to bring down. He will have the high and mighty serve as slaves. Popes cleaning out latrines in Israel. First, I was pushed, put aback by that. And the more I thought about it, the more appealing it became. You know, wouldn't you love to see old Donald Trump scrubbing out a urinal? You know, I'd put him in the ladies' bathroom, but blind. Have him scrubbing the floors. It's perfect.
God has everything in mind.
It's also interesting to note that Haran fathered Lot, who would, by the way, if you want to know how to pronounce the O and the W in Lot, it's L-O-W-T. So L-W-T is the name. The vowel is Lot. We all know it's Lot. That tells you. I mean, there isn't anybody that would say that his name is Lut? Voot?
Or Lat or any of those? No.
Yeah.
It's we know what an O is, an O.
Right, and Lot comes, the O sound comes from the Hebrew wa.
Yahweh.
Yahweh. Who would choose to live in Sodom. Lot's judgment was so compromised, he offered his daughter's virginity to the Moloch who were offering to protect him. Lot's wife also longed for the life that she had lived in Sodom, and she just couldn't walk
away. If you, by making that statement, if you long for the life of Sodom, and we know what Sodom was like, how corrupt are these people?
Yeah, bad. Yeah, they're.
I mean, it is Sodom is like hell on earth.
Yeah, that's why I know that in Christianity there's this myth that somehow that Lot is represents their rapture.
No.
And I think he even says that someplace. But no. Maybe he does represent.
My brain
he might represent their rapture, all right, because they ain't going to heaven. Lot's not in heaven.
No.
That's just the bottom line here. He was a scoundrel. Lot's inebriation caused him to engage in incest. Yes, indeed. Children have a tendency to follow in their father's footsteps. Unless we forget, Haran also had a daughter, one named Milcah, queen, who married his brother, Nahor, one who snored. She, in all likelihood, is the reason Nahor remained behind. His third child and second daughter, Yitzchak, was observant, which would have been good if it were not for the fact that she remained a student of Babel. When Yahweh mentions Sarai was infertile, it wasn't to tell us that she and her husband were childless. It was to reinforce the fact that man's way, the way of Babel, is sterile and barren, unable to conceive or uphold meaningful life. It would only be once Sarah and Abraham were in the covenant that they would enjoy conceiving life as Yahweh intended. It is at this point that we leave the city of Ur behind, of Satan's enlightened, and the Eretz, the realm and country of Kashtan Babel, the confusion and corruption of Babylon. And by the way, the religion, if we were to take the three religions most responsible are most based upon intermixing, commingling truth and lies. You'd have Christianity, Islam, and Judaism.
Yeah.
Of the world's religions, those three are the most guilty of commingling the truth and lies, of mixing things together. Be careful out there, Christians. He left behind, also left behind is Terach's Bereth home, including the rest of his family, Nahor, Milcah, and Yitzchak. As such, you have probably noted the connection that I missed. The three things Yahweh will soon ask Abram to walk away from were described in the preamble to the covenant. Moreover, he has already put each of them behind him. That's not the end of it. Abram's mortal father took them from the furnace of the fire, out of Babel and to Charan. There, Abram, Sarai, and Lot would live, and Terach would die, diseased by the sun in Charan. He had walked out of Babel with the rest of them, but that would not be nearly enough. The other three would continue their journey to God. Two of them would find him. Since this is of utmost importance, it ought to be understood. Yahweh first met with and spoke to Abram in Charan, not Babel. After compromising mankind's language and dulling human rhetoric, seeing to it that their religious alternatives would be nothing more than a blending together of words and ideas to convey common notions, God had no interest in returning. He would meet Abram halfway, after he'd begun the process of disassociating from his country, its religious and political customs, and his father's house. Now, this realization is breathtaking in its consequence, because it suggests that Yahweh will meet those of us who have begun this process along the way, introducing himself to us while providing initial directions. God did not find Abram mired in the midst of Babel, just as he did not approach Moshe in Mitzrayim. But had God not reached out when and where he did, there would have been no covenant.
Sure.
I don't know how I could make this. I mean, I would love just to end the show right there and let all that sink in. We won't. We'll go on. We have another 30 minutes this evening, and we will go on.
Mm-hmm.
But there's very little out there, folks, that's more important than that. If you are a religious Jew, God's not going to meet with you. You will never know him. He's not going to introduce himself until you throw away the Mishnah and the Talmud, until you get rid of all your religious dress-up clothes, until you walk away from the synagogue and the temple. It is only after you stop depending on the things of religion that you have a chance of knowing God. Those of you who...
I haven't really met anyone who wasn't in that situation, but when they finally started, when God talked to them, I mean, God talks to them when you start reading the Torah. So, but none of them start reading the Torah first. They start questioning that, and they literally walk away and then start a search, and then they find, unfortunately for this generation, we can find you online, and then we can start reading the translation for the first time correctly, or at least as correct as we can possibly find. So it's that's the way it has to be. That's the way it is. That's what he said here. This is, so I just don't, I haven't run across anybody that's done it any other way.
No, I don't think there's any, it's not even worth wasting your breath on somebody who is religious.
Yeah.
They're not going to understand. They're not going to be open.
You hope you like and you might want to, but having done it a lot, it is a waste of time. I don't do it now.
It's a complete and utter waste of time. If somebody is religious, they're closed off to God. God will not meet somebody who is religious. If you are going to a church, you are walking away from God, and he... So long as you go to church, so long as you believe in your religion, you have no chance whatsoever of knowing God.
So that's what the story tells you, right? And I'm
not
missing it. That's exactly the way Yah did it. If you want to do it like Yah.
Yep.
Then
that is what the story should be telling
you. Then you can tell.
Right. If you're doing what God wants you to do, is I'm telling you the story. Think about it. Why did I tell you the story this way? Why did God tell us where he first talked to Abram and where Abram had come from? And who had died and what their names were and where they had died?
Right. Just to let you know.
What do you think the purpose of that is?
Yeah. I mean, it's crystal clear now.
I want you to understand what death represents. One died in Haran. One died in Babylon. And then once they were dead and now Abram was on his own. God introduced himself to him.
Mm-hmm.
It's so powerful. Well,
tell you everything you need to know.
Yes.
I keep thinking back, you know, when it says the Torah is complete and ask any, every question you ask will be there. Yeah, we have to dig out a heck of a lot to read it, but that's what he wants you to do, is to study, get to know him, spend a lot of time with him.
Their meeting was brief and to the point, their initial meeting.
Uh-huh.
They would not engage in conversation or relationship for some time. There would be more meetings and steps along the way. I remember my first meeting with Yahweh. I was an agnostic at the time. I had left Christianity. Too many unanswerable questions. And it's not like, you know, that I didn't know the answer to those questions or couldn't figure out the answer. Those questions cannot be answered. There are 20 fundamental questions in Christianity which cannot be resolved. And the more you know, the worse it is. Like, you know, the ultimate one. How could God die for your sins?
Mm-hmm.
A God that can die is not God.
Yeah. You killed him.
And of course, the one that I think is the ultimate for a thinking individual is that if Christianity is half of its New Testament is based upon Paul's letters.
Right.
Paul claims to have been inspired by the God he consistently demeans and contradicts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's just not possible. It is not possible that God inspired a man to condemn his testimony and to contradict him.
Well, there's some Christians somewhere who think that there's something Christianity is not about Paul. If it's not, what is it about?
Oh, no. Christians think that Christianity is about Jesus Christ.
Sort of
Christ.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Nor that they're unaware that Yosha was Torah observant and vehemently opposed to anything that was anything other than Torah observant, and that Paul was Torah trashing.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the religion is Torah trashing, Torah disregarding, when Yosha was Torah observant, Torah loving, Torah living. And no, they can't figure that out.
They believe
that Jesus started their religion, even though Jesus was, Yosha was adverse to religion, and they don't give Paul credit for being the forefather of their religion, because they are clueless as to realize that Paul spoke for Satan, even admitted it. He didn't quote Yosha, he quote Yahweh accurately.
That's really bad.
That's really bad. But read the end of 2 Corinthians. He was demon-possessed. I had the opportunity to ask a Christian theologian, a couple of days ago. I said, so what was the thorn in Paul's side? I said, you know, I suspect maybe he was a homosexual. I said, well, you don't have to suspect he was a homosexual. That was not the thorn in his side. 666 years before Paul would utter his first words in his letter to the Galatians, told us that he'd be fascinated with the male genitalia. So, yeah, he was a homosexual. But surely, you've read the end of 2 Corinthians. What does it say? What was the thorn in Paul's side? Because it wasn't homosexuality. He answers the question. How come you don't know it? You're a theologian. That's
really
at the end of it. Yeah. I don't think there is one Christian in a million that knows the answer to that. They all know that Paul had a thorn in his side. They all speculate as to what it is. There's not one in a million that knows that Paul answered the question. In the same sentence that he speaks of the thorn in his side, he says that it's an envoy from Satan. Demon. He was demon-possessed. Yeah, it's staggering. I can't think it through. What this all suggests, and to my mind confirms, is that God recognizes that he has deliberately put himself at a distinct disadvantage on earth as a result of the way he has chosen to engage relative to his covenant. If we were left entirely on our own devices, fewer than one in a million would pick up a copy of his Torah and find their way to their heavenly Father. So Yahweh reaches out to those he suspects will be receptive to him, to those who have begun to question and disassociate from societal influences, especially religious rituals and political customs. His set-apart spirit can then provide those individuals with just enough guidance to help them continue to move in the right direction. But even then, the Ruach Kodesh does not leave her children to fend for themselves. So she continues to support their progress, guiding receptive men and women until the day comes that they decide of their own free will to engage in the covenant. And it's at this point that Yahweh is at his best. The universe was conceived to encourage and enable. Therefore, using this example, we can surmise that we do not find Yahweh entirely on our own. God reaches out to those who demonstrate a willingness to disavow humanity to know him. Had he not done so, I wouldn't be here. And if I was not here,
I wouldn't be here.
Then I would say that everyone that's listening to this program, not a single one of you would be here. Yahweh reached out to Moshe. Had he not reached out to Moshe, there would have been no Torah.
There'd been no Aaron. There'd been no Aaron or any Torah either.
Yeah,
same
right.
thing.
Yeah, if Yahweh reached out to Abram. If he had not reached out to Abram, there'd be no covenant.
Right.
And you might say, oh, he just found somebody else. Oh, yeah? Okay. Let's put it in real terms here.
Moshe with?
Yeah, that had grown up in Egypt, that understood the beast.
That was Yehuda.
That be recognized there. Who?
I mean, there.
Anybody
go
else,
back
he has to teach them all about Egypt and teach them all about the covenant. Who? Okay, let's just say that you take this thing the next step and say, all right, so if he didn't tap you on the shoulder and say, I want you to do this project with me, he'd have found somebody else. Oh, yeah? Pick one. I've been doing this now for 16 years. Why don't you tell me who? Because last time I checked, 100% of those who figured out the nature of the covenant and how to participate in it came because...
Yeah. Because I read your books.
I said yes.
Your analysis and went back and checked and said, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, he's right.
Don't bother me that you're right. I'm delighted.
Right. You know, if you read Yeshayah, one of the things you'll find out is that when Yeshayah first enters heaven, God's home, the most disturbing statement of all comes next.
Yes.
Yahweh laments because there's no one at heaven's door. Not one person taking advantage of the covenant.
I opened my doors and nobody came.
Yeah, I opened the door and no one came. Right. And then he talks through the prophet and says, you know, for all of these long centuries of time, there was no one. Not a soul.
And if you're one of those who think, well, he should have done something, he should have made it easier, what else could he do? He put it there. It's available. Anybody could go there and find it if they wanted to work that hard. And if eternal life is not worth working that hard, what is?
Yeah. What is?
So, I mean,
how are you going to spend your eternity?
He did everything. He asked the question. He said, what more can I do? So answer the question, what more could he have done? I can't find anything to do different without compromising.
We spent an hour this morning on two passages filled with names.
Yeah.
And we only hit the superficial stuff.
Yeah.
You know, if that doesn't trip your trigger, God doesn't want you to spend an eternity messing up his plans and his family and his home. You know, there's not only the terms and conditions of the covenant that are going to be laid out over the course of the following discussions, but also the test. You got to pass the test. Thank God there's a test.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you have hated to have someone who was parroting all of the covenant rhetoric, claiming to be covenant like Larry and Fred that, you know, just gone AWOL, and have them actually in the covenant with all of their disgusting and abusive rhetoric?
Uh-huh. Well, that's taken care of. You know, later we read where he's very emphatic about those who belittle, besmirch, and so forth. Abram, in his family, Yehudim. Mm-hmm. You know, I have nothing to do with you. So
I have nothing to do with you. Yeah.
No, so you go down that road and don't expect Yahweh to ever save you. He'll turn around. You'll never come back. He won't. I doubt if he'll even allow you to come back the next time.
No.
If it was the next time. So
there is a test. There's not just five terms and conditions. You've got to pass the test.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about parenting. I will tell you for certain that HaSatan knows the five conditions of the covenant. He certainly knows Yahweh's name.
He can make the speech.
Yeah. He can make the speech. That didn't do him any good. This being the case, I suspect that Yahweh relies on his Malach messengers to make the preliminary assessment, and that they know God's will and are similarly constrained, unconstrained by time. Yahweh's initial approach would then come by way of the Ruach Kodesh, the set-apart spirit. This would explain how Yahweh came to know about Abram's presence in Charan and why God was heard but not seen during their first meeting. Now, I heard God. I didn't see him. I didn't even know his name at the time of the day. He asked me to do a mission that no one in their right mind would accept.
Not with Islam.
No one in the West didn't
like it, and of course we had the benefit
no
of everybody's
surviving.
Up to you, buddy.
Yeah, no chance of surviving.
That's dangerous stuff.
The dangerous stuff. So, this would, the fact that he's introducing himself by way of the Malach, who, as I say, are unconstrained by time. Yet, since that would take, if God actually knew how we were going to respond at the time of the invitation, would take all the fun out of it for him. You know, if you knew how everything was going to develop with Terry before you drew the first picture of her and began a conversation, it would take all the fun out of the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So,
sure.
God doesn't want to know how we're going to react and how and what everything we're going to do for the rest of our lives when he says hello. It's just an invitation. So it's more likely that based upon his Malach assessment and individual's life and attitude, there is merely a reasonable likelihood of success. This would be a little like dating before marriage, introducing ourselves to someone we find attractive and have an interest in getting to know, even asking them out on a date. It does not constrain the other person's choices, but instead expands them. And most people wouldn't embarrass themselves by asking someone out that was likely to rudely reject them. Every relationship begins with an introduction. For something meaningful to develop from there, both parties have to agree to engage. And ultimately, they must not only like each other, but come to share common interests. So we ought not see Yahweh's waiting, just hoping that someone will read his Torah and answer his invitation. Now, so long as we are willing to meet him halfway, he will find a way to introduce himself and initiate a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That does not constrain our free will.
No.
It expands it. But even this wasn't my most glaring omission. So I'll ask you, is it possible that Yahweh could have actually asked Abram to walk away from his country, his community, and from his father's house, knowing he had already done so? It's a 600-mile walk from Ur to Haran. Since I suspect Yahweh is aware of the geography, walking away wasn't about leaving the physical place, but instead acquiring a new perspective. God wasn't thinking about the land of Mesopotamia, but instead of what Babel represents. Today's world is Christianity, Islam, Judaism. just because Abram at this point, had put a considerable space between him and Babel, it is still likely that he dragged some of its cultural holidays and rituals with him, including the influence of the Babylonian educational system and its six-based mode of counting. Therefore, the religious and political institutions which dominated society should be seen as its molideth. And the same is true as it relates to his father's home. It represents the family of man. The fact that Abram had physically separated himself from all three concerns, country, culture, and household, means that Yahweh was addressing the potential of a continued allegiance and thus the consequence of the ongoing influence of these things. It was, therefore, disassociating from what they represented that mattered to God. So let's just have a quick review of where we're going, Kirk. And if you have something you'd like to add, well, let's listen to that first.
Go ahead.
I was just saying, okay, here's a quick summation of the first meeting between Yahweh and Abram, and we'll dig into each word here in a moment. It begins. Now, Yahweh said to Abram, now Yahweh said to Abram, at this time, at this place, are you following the story?
Mm-hmm.
It is for you, of your own free will, to approach by walking away from your country and away from your relatives' culture and customs, and also from your father's household, to the land which bestows the blessings of the relationship, which I will show you. Then I will engage on your behalf, continually acting to make for you a greatly empowered community comprised of every race, coming together, both based upon a common relationship. And I will kneel down in love to bless you by lifting you up. And I will cause, as an expression of my will, your name to continuously grow in importance, so that you come to exist as a blessing, as a means of reconciliation in the covenant, creating a better circumstance. Then I will choose to favor and hold you in high regard, because it will be my desire and choice to kneel down in love to greet you and welcome you in the spirit of reconciliation, blessing, uplifting, and showering you with gifts and prosperity, offering a beneficial covenant where the gift of life is afforded to those who hold you in high regard, who see you as a source of blessings, of reconciliation, and of the beneficial covenant. But then he who disdains or despises you, even trivializes you, he who views you as someone to be slighted, belittled, or underestimated, making you of little account, he who diminishes your overall significance or who dishonors you in any way, as well as he who causes anything associated with you to be seen as so simple and easy that it is underestimated and not taken seriously, I will actually besmirch as disrespectful and will continuously incarcerate as inferior. And I will genuinely curse as profane, obscene, and blasphemous. And I will designate as embittered. I will forever constrain and condemn as a consequence and penalty. And I absolutely will not bless them.
You turn on him.
Yeah.
Sorry.
In fact, I'll go ahead and read through this, and then let's go back to that.
I'll take your point.
Because there's a subtlety there that I don't want anybody to miss. Yeah. So with you, all the people exercising good judgment regarding the means to resolve disputes, the extended family who are discerning and vindicated through the material realm shall be commended and blessed, reconciled and greeted. So then Abram actually and continuously walked accordingly to the way Yahweh had expressed in words to him. And walking with him was Lot. Then Abram was a son of 75 years at his departure from Charan. that whole speech about he who despises you and disdains you and slights you and belittles you, who thinks that trivializes you, underestimates you, doesn't take you seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was speaking of himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's
yes, he is talking about Abraham's role in forming the covenant, but Abraham's very name represents Yahweh.
Yeah, one of those lips.
All those people who say, oh, my faith is in Jesus Christ, well, then you have diminished the overall significance of Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
My religion is based on the New Testament. Then you have forsaken, and trivialized, and negated, and slighted, and belittled, and underestimated
covenant.
The testimony of Yahweh and the Torah, prophets, and Psalms.
Yeah.
If you disdain or despise Yahweh, trivialize his Torah, slight his, belittle what he has to say, and you will end up being forever incarcerated, or at the very best, die. You know, it's obvious that Abraham, merciful father who is enriching, was named such that he is Yahweh in this story.
Right.
Yeah. Abraham was a real individual, and everything that we read is true of him being an individual. But the story isn't told for the sake of Abraham. The story is Yahweh's story. The covenant is his family, and he's the father of the covenant. And so it is a true story that serves as the single most important parable ever told to humankind. The same thing is true to a lesser degree, but with the story of Noah and the Ark. The same thing is true to a lesser degree with the story of Adam in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
These are true historical accounts of real individuals and the conversations and dialogue they had with God Almighty. But all three primarily serve as parables.
Yeah.
The stories for us to learn. And in each of those stories, the Father is God himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, it goes on even further. You know, it keeps on going, the same story, because you've got Samuel when he tells Samuel, they're not rejecting you.
They're rejecting me. Right.
It's Shaul.
If you are belittling the Father who uplifts, you're belittling Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
If you're slighting, underestimating Abraham, you're slighting and underestimating the role of the covenant. I mean, there isn't a religious person out there, not one, places their faith in the covenant, that goes to church, to mosque, or synagogue saying, I'm covenant. I know the five terms and conditions. I have accepted them. I've accepted the benefits of the covenant. That I have listened to what Yahweh said to Abram, how Abram responded, and I have listened, understood, and engaged in the same way. There's no one that's doing that that's part of a religious organization.
Yep.
And so it's literally true if you in any way slight the conversations that Yahweh had with Abram, then you will never see heaven, eternal life in heaven. Not possible for you. So it's true, literally, of Abram. But that's not the Father that is being spoken of here. This is Yahweh speaking of himself. And it should be. The covenant is his. All of the benefits come from him.
Mm-hmm. He enables it.
All right. He didn't. There is no reason for Yahweh to chronicle all of this in his Torah for Abraham's benefit.
No.
By the time the Torah is written, Abraham had been dead for 450 years.
Yeah.
It's not written for Abraham's benefit.
No.
It's written for ours. And the only way that it can be our benefit is for us to understand the lesson of the story.
Yeah, get our perspective right.
Right.
Exactly.
You know, Noah did not need Yahweh's detailed instructions written down in the Torah on how to build the ark.
But
that ship had already sailed.
Yeah.
You know, Adam did not need the Torah's explanation of what tree to eat from and what tree not to touch.
Mm-hmm. He was told.
It's there for our benefit, not theirs. This story of the covenant manifest with Abraham is not told for Abraham's benefit, but for ours. And until you view it from that perspective, it isn't going to be of any value to you. If you're just going to read this as a, well, this is the conversation God had with that guy. Isn't that nice? Well, all right, now, how am I going to get to know him? How am I going to deal with him? The story is being told because God wants you to know how to engage in a relationship with him. There's only one way. This is the way. So I don't think there's anything, Kirk, that we can cover more important than this.
No, not at all.
What did God have to say to Abraham? What did he offer him? What did he expect from him? How do we become members of the covenant? And how do we pass the test at the end?
Yeah, I told you that this has become my favorite chapter. This is just,
yeah.
It just resonates all. Oh, hey. There's little thrill bumps all the time.
It is.
It is.
Every bit of this, there's so much to dig deep and learn. And it's the essence of life. There's no other way to life in God's presence. This is it. So we're going to spend a lot of time on these two chapters. We're on page 12 now of 100 and chapter 10 of Observations for Our Time.
Yeah.
And chapter 11 of Observations for Our Time is not exactly short. It's 108 pages. So we're 12 pages into what will be 208.
Just flying through this, doesn't it?
Right.
You know, why would you want to rush through this?
This is the essence of how you form a relationship with God.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things we want to know. There's a lot of things, but this on my desk for all these years.
Mm-hmm.
I have these two piles of papers. One of them has the 10 statements in stone and everything I can find on it in a pile. And one of these days I'm actually going to go back. I nibble at it, then I have something else to do. And then I have another pile over there that is this. And it's the most important group of stuff. If there was a fire or something, I would grab those two things if I possibly could, just because it's... I get it again now, but at the time, I recognize right away. These are just, if I couldn't hear you talking and I couldn't speak to people about this and get the books and everything, I would at least have that. I could explore that for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Yeah, but there is reason to cover the other material because God, you know.
Oh, I'm not pursuing that. I'm just saying.
And you and I all know that we gain a lot when we come to understand who Satan is and how he operates. And
yeah.
We gain a lot when you understand why God is so opposed to religion and militarism and the like and politics. And some of the stories of how we learn and how we think and the like are marvelous. But it all boils down to what does it take to spend eternity with God in heaven?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All of that is presented in Bava Sheet, beginning in the 12th chapter. Actually, the 11th chapter, because the 11th chapter really is the preamble to the meeting, and it's important to understand that preamble. So it begins in the 11th chapter and then runs through Bava Sheet. This is it.
But once you have a relationship, then you got the rest of your life to explore everything else. This one in the next. So,
yes. Yep. Now, so, as we said, by Yahweh introducing himself to people that he would like to get to know, just like a guy walking up to a pretty girl that wants to get to know her, he or she, in that case, or Yahweh with us, He's not constraining our options, our free will. He's increasing our options, increasing the scope of our free will. But that increase and that introduction does us no good whatsoever if we don't go where his words lead. If Abram says, thanks for the introduction, that was really cool, then it wouldn't have done him any good. If Noah said, you know, God, it's really neat that you, you know, I'm out here living like a hermit, but it's really neat that you had this talk with me, but, you know, I'm just not a boat builder. I'm not going to build a ship in the middle of the dry land here. But it was, hey, it was neat talking
nice
to you.
To you. Yeah.
You know, I have a really good heart, so...
Ain't that enough?
Ain't that enough? No.
No, it
ain't. You know, Abram says, yeah, you know, Abram can say, no, I'm pretty comfy here in Haran. It's a civilized place. I appreciate you saying all those nice things about me, but, you know, why do I want to go to Canaan?
I got my tent parked over there. You know, everything. Cool. No. This is never been a dull moment, Craig, from the start. This has been the best walk of my life.
Yeah, it has been. Yeah, it's God is a lot of fun.
Uh-huh.
Always teaching, always laughing. I can't say always laughing. He's there's a lot of things about Christ that bother him a lot. But with his children, he's always laughing.
He's fun to be around.
He is fun to be around for his kids.
Yeah,
he is worth knowing. I had a Yehuda that wrote me the other day, and she was saying that for most of her life, she was just, like most Jews, mad at God.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, gosh, when you come to know him, how could he be mad at him? He's just so likable, lovable, nice, fun. You know, so I was, you know, she said, I was angry at the human manifestations of God, not the real God. The real God's very approachable, likable. Fun to be around.
I mean, yeah, it's brilliant. Brilliant stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, Kirk. Well, thank you very much. I will be back with you next week. I am still headed to knee surgery, and there's a lot of stuff that's going on that is taking some of my time and focus, but my goal here is to complete the 21st chapter, and I probably will have to write one more chapter to kind of keep, to create some balance between volumes 1 and volume 2 of observations for our time, and begin to get some of this out. You know, right now I've got volume 1 has to go through chapter 11, this next chapter, because it's all about the covenant, and then volume 2 can begin with what was chapter 12. It'll not be volume 2, chapter 1. And that makes chapter 21 that I'm working on right now becomes chapter 10 in the second volume. Probably going to have 11 chapters in it, too, and make our way through one more chapter and Yashaya to have things be a little more evened out. But I shared with you earlier today that Yashaya 14 is really difficult for me because the single most controversial conclusion I've ever come to in my life is laid out unequivocally in it. And, you know, they always talk about what's more important, the journey or the destination. And you know, I'm a journey sort of a guy. I like the journey of discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And here in this journey of discovery, this thing I've been working to now for 1,500 pages of observations for our time, suspecting that this is where we were headed, has been just been laid out on the plate and said, yeah, exactly what you thought is true. That indeed, Satan is the god of Christianity and of Islam and of Judaism.
Yeah, I never
Satan didn't say, I want to be greater than the Most High. He said, want to be known as God.
Mm-hmm.
And,
you know, if I picture it all, just me.
That's so important, so profound, so uncommon, so poorly known and understood. So incompatible with everything man has preached for 6,000 years. And yet, from my perspective, as I came to know Yahweh, I came to know who HaShatan is and why religions exist, it became so obvious to me. I just never expected it to be so blunt. That, yes, of course, that's the way it is. So I'm at a first time in my life as I read Yah's word, I don't know what words to add.
I mean, just put them both and say, look at there.
Looky there.
Behold.
Behold, yeah. Satan is indeed the God of Christianity. He is indeed the God of Islam. They're worshiping Satan as Christians, as Muslims, as rabbinic Jews in Judaism. But the carnage is so great. That's why when Yahweh returns and he obliterates all traces of religion and militarism and nationalism from the face of the earth, virtually nothing left. You know, we're going to... 7 billion people are going
to
die.
Carnage is hard to... It's overwhelming to think about, but yes.
It is overwhelming to think about, but God's not going to populate the earth with anybody that has any traces of religion, politics, militarism, the stigma and the stain of those things. Not going to fall. And, you know, the only thing that was ever confusing to me, Kirk, because clearly the Israelites that Yahweh reconciles his relationship with in the end,
right,
and who come to know him, that God has to introduce himself to them. In the midst of all that, they are not going to suddenly go from depending on their religion and their military and their country and one another to letting go of all of that and to reach up to him and embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant if God doesn't introduce himself to them.
Yeah, they'll be playing duck and cover, and they won't have a chance, you know,
right,
if he doesn't. Yeah, so
and that's what the role, I think, that observations for our time plays.
Well, I just think it's so timely. I remember watching a TV program with the current prime minister of Israel, and he's touring these people around, and here's in the great Isaiah scroll is right here, and it's right there in the midst of them, and this is all about Yeshua, rather. You couldn't put the two together any better. So right, they are, if we are mostly an English-speaking world, which we are, they get both barrels, and when they can read the Hebrew better, they can look over there and say, oh my gosh, it really says it's right there on the scroll.
Yeah, and you know, of course, the alphabet that's used in the Great Isaiah Scroll is very different than the alphabet of the Babylonian Hebrew and the modern Hebrew that they're reading, and it's very different than the Masoretic with its diacritical markings.
Right.
I'm not sure that even being versed in Hebrew, that they would be able to read it, and. I'm quite convinced that being fluent in Hebrew is a liability now. It will be an asset later, but right now it's a liability because there's too much of culture, too much of the religious establishment staining the words for those who can read and speak Hebrew to do the kind of investigations that we've done to understand what these words mean. This is not a superficial presentation. If you just think God named some people and some of them died in Ur, some died in Haran, and here we go, and you don't bother to look up the names and come to see what they represent, then the story isn't going to resonate with you. You're not going to learn anything from it. You'll be no closer to God when you started it than you were when you finished it.
Yeah,
so that's kind of the problem of being literate in Hebrew as opposed to being literate in English and having to study the Hebrew.
Yeah.
I think we have an advantage, and I think that's why the sign is being written in English.
Yeah.
It's not the language that God uses, but the sign is being is written in English to explain the Hebrew.
Right.
And to a greater and greater extent, I think finally by the time I, you know, began observations, having written all the other books, I think mm-hmm. that finally at this point that I'm beginning to think in Hebrew. And so even though it's written in English, the thought process is still Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important because, you know, Hebrew is this timeless language, no past, present, or future. A relational language where the stems all convey a relationship between the object and the subject, and a volitional language where the moods convey free will. And a graphic language.
Yeah, you do write that way, though. I mean, you're absolutely, obviously thinking that way because everything I look up and everything I study is yeah, that's the way, yeah.
Yeah, you have to.
Very confirming.
You have to think in Hebrew.
What you'll find.
You have to start thinking in Hebrew if you're going to start thinking like God. And that's ultimately, if you can't think like God, and by thinking like God, I'm not saying that, you know, we're as smart as God. But if you don't begin to think in the manner that he thinks,
mm-hmm.
you really can't engage in telling people about him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're, like I'm anti-political, anti-religious. Well,
yes.
You have to be anti-political and anti-religious to reflect Yahweh's nature. If you're not, you can't speak for him. You've got to love Hebrew if you're going to speak for him. Those people say, I don't have time to learn Hebrew. Well, then you don't have time to know God. Sorry for you. Wait a minute. You're just saying because I don't have the time to learn Hebrew that I can't know God. That's what I'm saying. Because you can read this in English. But it's not written about things in English. It's written about Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you read it, you're going to learn a lot about Hebrew. If you don't have time, that's okay. You just never know God.
Yeah, you just don't want to. You can find
You got to have the want to.
Yeah.
You know, what you say is you were doing the first program of the day, that you were rereading chapter 10 and studying each of the words to prepare for it. You got to have the want to.
Yeah.
It's not a burden.
But you have to want to spend the time to do it.
Right.
A lot of things
right.
you spend your time on, this happens to be the most important thing I can think of in the universe.
Yeah.
Certainly in my life. So,
yeah. And, you know, it really is, you know, some people think it's for, you know, our devotion to this, but the reality is we're the biggest beneficiaries. You and I do it if there's just the two of us.
Well, I'd do it if it was the one of us.
Yeah.
In some way, we couldn't contact one another. We couldn't do this. Participate with me.
Sure.
You know,
of course it was.
I do it just
for me.
Well,
sure.
I got all this stuff.
You do it just for you.
I have a great time.
It's more fun sharing it.
Yeah, but we won't do it. But it would be no drop off in the sense of studying to try to figure out everything. And then, of course, you always try to share it. It's just part of the nature of doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, what a marvelous opportunity.
Yeah, and the single most important story told throughout the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms is the one that we're covering now.
Mm-hmm.
This is the heart of the story, the covenant.
Yeah. Well, thank you for doing so much, Evan.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's fun. I enjoyed both shows with you today.
Yeah, thank you very
much. God bless.
Shalom.
Good night, my friend. Yeah, good night, my friend. Bye-bye.
Yes, sir.